Thank you, Kimberly, for that beautiful introduction, which I could not possibly follow up. And thank you, Dr. Van Hildebrand, for a talk that I thought it was going to be difficult to follow, but now I realize I was wrong. It's going to be impossible. I feel like just sneaking off and going home. If Adam was the first wimp, that makes me the second wimp. I guess by Chesterton standards, though, that makes me courageous. I am certainly in awe of this lady. The last time I taught a course on C.S. Lewis to 200 students at Boston College, nearly all those students agreed with nearly everything he wrote in a dozen books and a dozen articles that we read, except for one thing. Most of the students not only disagreed with, but felt very strongly that Lewis was scandalously out of line in opposing priestesses in his wonderful little article, Priestesses in the Church? The issue looms large, too large, I think, at least compared with the apocalyptic cosmic spiritual war we are in, as for the first time in all of human history, as the Pope has said, the eclipse of God has descended massively on the Western world. And yet there is a connection between this larger issue and this smaller one. I do not think that I or an angel from heaven could convince and convert the one-third who are passionately committed to the cause for priestesses. But a sorting out and summarizing of reasons against priestesses and for the church's teaching may help sway the one-third who are not passionately committed to either side, and it would be helpful for the one-third who are committed to the church's position to take an inventory of their intellectual weapons. That is my purpose here. I don't think I have any new arguments, just restatements of others' arguments. But I don't know of any such summary of all the arguments that I could send someone to who asks me for it. The closest thing I know is an article that is, as far as I know, still unpublished by a man named Chris Kaiser, from which many of my arguments here are going to come. So, since I write the books and articles that I'd like to read, but can't because nobody else does it, so I have to, here is my attempt to summarize in less than an hour the church's case for the controversial proposition that only boys can be the daddies. That's straight from Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. I shall present only one side of the issue, the church's side, because the arguments on the other side are very simple and very obvious. They come down to why not? The idea of priestesses is not guilty until proven innocent, but innocent until proven guilty. The onus of proof, it seems, is on the church's side. I will accept that onus of proof and try to prove the idea guilty. Before looking at the substantive arguments, however, I think it is useful and honest to look at ourselves and our prejudices first, because they are in fact operative in the discussion. Four in particular move us today, all in the direction of saying yes to priestesses: the power of positive thinking, egalitarianism, guilt about male chauvinism, and the desire for peace. First, we always prefer positive thoughts and feelings to negative ones. We'd rather say yes than say no. But God gave us no as well as yes. Ann Landers defines personality as the ability to say yes and character as the ability to say no. We need both. We need negativity, limits, narrowness, borders, or else nothing will have definition and character. Without the negative, no positive. We especially hate limitations that make us suffer: poverty, disease, weakness. I think God must have arranged our lives to be full of lived limits like these, partly because without such limits, there is no drama. One of the saddest things about being filthy rich, I imagine, is the lack of limits. You can do nearly anything, and therefore the lack of drama and bite in life. The rich always have a much higher suicide rate than the poor. The one society on Earth with a zero suicide rate is the poorest and most primitive society on Earth, the Australian Aborigines. So it behooves us to say a preliminary hurrah for limits and barriers, and a yes to no in principle. But in fact, we say the opposite. Second, we, especially we Americans, are egalitarians. We hate discrimination. But discrimination is one aspect of limit, of the no. God discriminated between men and women in creating us different. We may rebel against this, but it is rebelling against our own nature. Already, by nature and the will of the Creator, men are barred from getting pregnant and childbirth. And women are barred from impregnating. God is just, but God's justice is far greater and richer and more mysterious than mere equality. God's justice is harmony, like music, not mathematics, like an equation. The ancients understood this justice because they lived in a natural cosmos, not a man-made and artificial one, surrounded by technological and political complexities and artifices. Human justice has a rightful concern for equality because we need to protect ourselves and our rights against others, like fascists, who would impose an unnatural and unjust inequality on us. But we also need to protect ourselves against those who, like the communists, would impose an unnatural and unjust equality upon us. It is simply not true that deep down we're all the same. The deeper down you go, the more the secret of our uniqueness is found. Ultimately, we find the difference between the heavenly and the hellish, the thoroughly and successfully human and the thoroughly and eternally inhuman, deep down. In the book of Genesis, not all discrimination and differentiation is between good and evil. God introduces distinctions into creation, including the distinction between male and female, for good. In fact, each act of creation is an act of discrimination. Light from darkness, waters below the firmament from waters above the firmament, land from sea, living from non-living, animal from plant, birds from fish, one species from another, man generically from animal, and man male from female. A third prejudice is that we men today are especially sensitive to women's demands out of guilt. A double guilt. First, guilt for past scorn and prejudice against women as inferiors by many of our ancestors. And second, guilt for present dehumanizing violence, raping, and battering by our brothers. But our ancestors and our brothers are not us. We are not personally responsible and guilty for their sins against women. Yet, though we may not rightly feel guilt for these sins, we do naturally and rightly feel shame, for they are our fathers and brothers. It's all in the family. If you found that Adolf Hitler was literally your grandfather, you would naturally feel shame for this black sheep in your family. Now, we want to relieve this shame and compensate for these wrongs, as affirmative action tries to compensate for slavery, or a professor bending over backwards to give a good grade to a student he dislikes and has been unfair to. The danger here is overcompensation, responding to past injustice by present opposite injustice, trying to make a right out of two wrongs. A fourth and less praiseworthy motive than the well-meaning but misdirected attempt to compensate for past wrongs is the fear of present trouble, the lust for comfort, the giving in to intimidation, the fanatical desire not to be seen as a fanatic, or modernity's other F word, fundamentalist. Get those pushy, pesty feminists off our back. Give them what they want. Americans, especially American administrators, including many church administrators, usually have a tremendous desire to be accepted, to be accommodating, to be nice. As Bill Cosby says about parents, we don't want justice, we want quiet. But these considerations decide nothing. They just warned us. What decides the issue is good arguments. Rather, what should decide the issue, any issue, is good arguments. I assume, perhaps naively, that everyone in my audience still believes in the existence and desirability of objective truth and the power of human reason to know it, and even, sometimes, to prove it. If that faith is dead, so is civilization. Barbarism defeats all civilization very effectively, just as a bull defeats a china shop. I think this is the bottom line of Nietzsche's philosophy and of its progeny today, deconstructionism. There are at least four kinds of reasons against priestesses. First, reasons of authority. Second, reasons of sexual symbolism. Third, reasons of the ecclesiastical common good. And fourth, reasons of discernment. First, reasons of authority. These are the simplest of all. There are at least three: the argument from the authority of God, from the authority of Christ, and from the authority of the Church. First, God. God is the one who invented the priesthood and who calls to the priesthood. The Church did not invent the priesthood. She received it. The Catholic Church claims less authority than any other Christian church in the world. That is why she is so conservative, so stuck in the mud. Protestant churches feel free to change the deposit of faith, for instance, by denying Mary's Assumption, or to change the deposit of morals, for instance, by allowing divorce, though Christ clearly forbade it in all four Gospels, or changing the essence of the liturgy, for instance, by denying the real presence and the centrality of the Eucharist in worship, which was constant church practice from the beginning. That historical discovery, by the way, played an enormous role in my own conversion from Protestantism. The Church, then, cannot change the nature of her priesthood simply because she is not its author, or even its editor, only its mail carrier. The Catholic priesthood was not the first priesthood that God invented. He created two others before it: the Levitical priesthood, which was set aside by Christ, and the priesthood of Melchizedek, which was fulfilled by Christ. Just as the Jews were not free to institute priestesses, neither are Catholics. All other ancient religions, except for Jews and Catholics, had priestesses, by the way. In a letter to the National Catholic Register, Lawrence Severson wrote, "No one can choose, much less demand, the priesthood. Christ said, 'You have not chosen me, I have chosen you.' The issue was closed right there. The chosen people did not establish the Jewish priesthood. It was established by the Supreme Being. All priests, he said, had to come from the sons of the tribe of Levi. Did God then discriminate against members of the other 11 tribes, both men and women? What an absurdity. God picks his priests, and they serve at his pleasure. When some men outside the tribe of Levi, under Kor, tried to perform the religious ceremonies, Moses warned them. When they continued to be obstinate, they were destroyed. Christ established the priesthood of the new covenant. Man had no say in the matter. Christ exercised his authority as God, and also by his death on the cross, purchased the right to set the conditions under which all sacraments, including holy orders, are instituted and administered." One can wonder, however, why Christ chose only males to be apostles. The advocates of priestesses must say, and they do, that he bowed to cultural limitations, to deep-seated ancient male chauvinistic prejudices. But if Christ himself was subject to the limitations of cultural chauvinism, this is a denial of the incarnation, and thus the essence of the Christian faith. Imagine the absurdity and the arrogance of accusing Jesus Christ of the sin of sexism. In the second place, if he was not a sexist himself, but tolerated sexism in deliberately choosing only male apostles, then he's compromising with and fostering the sin of sexism by feminist standards. And this does not fit the pattern throughout the Gospels, where we see him unafraid to offend smaller and greater prejudices and sensibilities than this one. For instance, when he and his disciples eat with unwashed hands, and when he tells the Jews that they must drink his blood. So why would he succumb only to this one prejudice? In the third place, there was no consensus against priestesses in the ancient world. All the other nations had them, and the Jews frequently succumbed to the temptation of syncretism by imitating pagan practices throughout their history. Louis Boyer writes, "From the earliest civilizations of the Fertile Crescent through the Greece and Rome of the early Christian era, the ancients had always been accustomed to female priests who were not in the least in an inferior position to male priests. The male priesthood, contrary to contemporary popular prejudice, was an anomaly in the ancient world, as was the Jewish idea of a creator God, totally transcendent to the universe, who created its very matter out of nothing. As we shall see in our next main point, the argument from sexual symbolism, there is an intrinsic and necessary connection between this transcendence of God as creator and the male priesthood, and between the denial of the transcendence of God and the female priesthood. In both pagan polytheism and in pantheism, God is not outside nature, but in her, either as a part, like Zeus, or as the whole, like Brahman. Thus, these religions can quite properly symbolize God as female, and they did. Only in Judaism and Christianity do we find the doctrine of creation proper and divine transcendence proper, and exclusively masculine imagery and pronouns for God, and an exclusively male priesthood symbolizing this. Further, there is no evidence at all of priestesses at any time or place in the New Testament or in the primitive church. There is, in fact, explicit evidence to the contrary in St. Paul. In addition to the authority of God in the Old Testament and of Christ in the New, the authority of Christ's appointed church for 2,000 years of uniform, unbroken, and unexceptionable practice and teaching supports priests and not priestesses. Even on a merely secular and human level, 2,000 years of uniform tradition that worked counts as empirical data. And if you're truly democratic, as a vote from the democracy of the dead, to use Chesterton's wonderful term. The same Chesterton, always brimming with common sense, says that if we don't understand the reason for some ancient tradition or rule or institution, that should be a good reason for not abolishing it until we do understand it. If you come across a fence or a gate or a house in some unexpected place where you don't understand why it should be there, knocking it down because you don't understand why it's there is the really stupid thing to do. Knock it down, if you must, only after you understand its purpose and why it's no longer needed. But those who are advocating knocking down the old rule of a male priesthood freely admit that they haven't the faintest idea why the rule is there. Well, we do. So the only people who might have a right to change the old rule are precisely the people who don't want to change it. And the people who don't have a right to change it because they don't understand it are precisely the people who do want to change it. The church is our mater et magistra, our mother and teacher. Let's have no mater si magistra no. From the right or the left. Ideology does not judge the church. The church judges ideologies. To be a Catholic is to believe that the church and her traditions are more than human, that she is the body of Jesus Christ, graced with his real presence and power and promise of guidance. I have not yet once heard one advocate of priestesses face and affirm this fact, or manifest the loyal submission that all the saints had to our Holy Mother. When feminists become saints, we will become their pupils. The position I have stated here is no a priori prejudice against change in the church. Many of the saints called for and carried out changes in the church. The church is a living body and therefore grows. But she grows from within, like a natural body. Not violently or artificially, like a machine or an ideology. As I shall show in main point number 2, a change to priestesses would manifest not growth and maturity, but an identity crisis. The church has said no to priestesses, not only from her beginning, from apostolic times, not only through nearly 2,000 years of past history, but also today. It is a simple and massive fact that the church today has spoken, magisterially, officially, authoritatively, clearly, and publicly. What more does anybody want? Rome has spoken, the case is closed. That formula used to evoke love and loyalty. The issue today is not whether the church will have priestesses. She won't. The only open issue today is whether the would-be priestesses will have the church. The issue is not theoretical, but practical. It is a test of everyone's loyalty to the church and therefore to Christ. For the head is not related to his body as a CEO to a business, but as that funny pink ball between your shoulders to the four-limbed flesh beneath it. To say yes to Christ but no to his church is to will a spiritual decapitation. Today's rebels against the church's authority on this or any other issue always misunderstand the very essence of authority. Authority does not mean power. It means right. More, it means author's rights. Christ is the author of the church and has rightful authority over his own body, his own organs, that is, us, unless we are not his organs, his body, in which case we are not Christians, not sheep, but goats. His sheep follow him, not lead him, because they know his voice, they recognize his authority. Now, this is all we need to say about the issue of priestesses. The case is closed. We can be certain of what is true and right here, even if we do not know or understand the reasons. But it is good to understand the reasons why. And the church, like a good mother, has told us not only, do this because mommy says so, but also, mommy wants you to know why she says so. And her main reason is my second main point, the meaning of sexual symbolism. The first two things we learn about sex from God, right from the beginning, is that God designed it, not man or society, and that it is very good. The first command was, be fruitful and multiply. I do not think God had in mind growing oranges and memorizing times tables. It is significant that most advocates of priestesses do not seem to believe or care much about this. They usually see sexuality as a social, human, conventional, changeable thing, and they often see it as a problem, an obstacle, or even an enemy. In the case of radical feminists railing against the prison of having wombs and glorifying the act of breaking out of this prison by killing their unborn babies. If they see their bodies and their sexuality as theirs and not God's, it is quite naturally that they should proceed to the next step of seeing their babies as theirs and not God's. Advocates of priestesses usually misunderstand sexual symbolism, partly because they misunderstand symbolism itself as radically as they misunderstand authority. They usually think of symbols as only man-made and artificial. They don't see that there are profound and unchangeable natural symbols, that things can be signs. Aquinas based his multiple method of scriptural exegesis on this eminently sound but tragically forgotten principle. He writes, "The author of Holy Writ is God, in whose power it is to signify his meaning not by words only, as man also can do, but also by things themselves. Thus, whereas in every other science, things are signified by man's words, this science, sacred science, has the property that the things signified by the words of Scripture have themselves a signification. Therefore, that first signification, whereby words signify things, belongs to the first sense, the historical or literal, and that signification whereby the things signified by the words have themselves a signification is called the spiritual sense, which is based on the literal and presupposes it. In other words, God writes history and nature as man writes words. Behind this hermeneutic is a metaphysic. the sacramental view of nature and history. Professor Howard has brilliantly pinpointed the difference between this ancient worldview in which everything means something and the reductionistic modern worldview in which nothing means anything in his title and book, Chance or the Dance. If everything in nature means something, then the big things in nature mean something big. And sex is a big thing. What it means is so big that we will never exhaust it. We can hope for ever-increasing, ever-changing insights into the facets of this diamond, but we cannot hope and should not hope to change its meaning, only to discover more of it. Every good poet knows that natural symbols are like the essential structures of language itself. The sky is, always was, and always will be a natural symbol for heaven. The ground is not. The eyes seeing is a natural symbol for the mind's understanding. The gut's desiring is not. We all know and recognize this unconsciously. That is why our language has evolved as it has, using the same word, see, for both literal physical seeing and symbolic seeing or understanding. Ascending light notes in a major key inevitably mean hope and joy. Descending heavy notes in a minor key inevitably mean something heavy, despair. Everything is connected. Everything points beyond itself. Especially sex. God, who deliberately designed sexuality, also deliberately designed to incarnate himself as a male. Jesus Christ is still a male today. He still has his human body in heaven, and it is a male body. This is fact. This is data. This is not interpretation or explanation. I will now try to explain and interpret the Church's no to priestesses in the light of this data. My explanation can be summarized in two propositions. First, priests of Christ, who are Christ's mouths, through whom he speaks the words, "This is my body," must be male because Christ is male. And second, Christ, the perfect human image of the Father, is male because God the Father is masculine, he, not she. To understand this second proposition, we must distinguish male from masculine. Male and female are biological genders. Masculine and feminine, or yin and yang, yang and yin, as the Chinese call them, are cosmic universal principles extending to all reality. Every pre-modern civilization knew this. English is the only language I know of which does not have masculine and feminine nouns. So it is easy for us who speak English to believe that the ancients merely projected their own biological gender out onto nature in calling heaven masculine and earth feminine, placing gods in the sky and goddesses in the earth, calling day and the sun masculine and night and the moon feminine. In the Hindu marriage ceremony, the bridegroom says to the bride, "I am heaven, you are earth," and the bride replies, "I am earth, you are heaven." I think it is incredibly provincial and even arrogant for us to assume without a shred of proof that this nearly universal human instinct is mere projection, mere illusion, mere fantasy, rather than an insight into a cosmic principle that is really there. There is abundant, ubiquitous, and obvious evidence for it from the bottom of the cosmic hierarchy to the top, from the electromagnetic attraction between electrons and protons to the circumcision of divine persons in the Trinity. Male and female are only the biological version of cosmic masculine and feminine. God is masculine to everything, from angels to prime matter. That is the ultimate reason why priests who represent God to us must be male. To say God is masculine is not, as so often said, male chauvinism. On the contrary, it makes us all female. To God, we are all his bride. All souls are feminine to God. He is he, and we are all she. The point can best be appreciated historically. Judaism was totally different from all the other religions of the world in three ways. First, there were no goddesses and no hermaphroditic gods. God, the only God, was always, only, and everywhere he. Therefore, there were also no priestesses. Second, the Jewish God was utterly transcendent to the universe. He created the universe out of nothing. He was not a part of the universe, as in polytheism, nor the whole of the universe, or the soul of the universe, or the inner meaning of the universe, as in pantheism. Third, God spoke. God revealed himself. God came out of hiding. All other religions were man's search for God. Judaism, and the Christianity was, which was its child, was God's search for man. Religious experience for a Jew was response, not initiative. There were no yoga methods. God initiated, man responded. The primary connector between God and man in Judaism was the law. God had a will and spoke his will in thou shalt and thou shalt nots. The God of pantheism may be consciousness, but he is not will. That is why only in Judaism do you have a full union of religion and morality, a full union of relationship with God and relationship with the moral law. Only the Jews united mankind's two primary spiritual instincts, the instinct to worship and the instinct of conscience. Only the Jews totally identified the object and end of worship with the author of conscience and the law. These three remarkably distinct features of ancient Judaism, God's masculinity, God's transcendence, and God's revelation, are obviously connected. As a man comes into a woman's body from without to impregnate her, so God creates the universe from without and performs miracles in it from without. He also calls to man, reveals himself and his law to man from without. He is not the force, he is the face. He is not earth spirit rising, he is the heavenly father descending. He is not the ideal construct of man's mind, he is the hound of heaven. C.S. Lewis says that to speak of man's search for God is like speaking of the mouse's search for the cat. I think the fundamental problem with the advocates of priestesses is that they do not understand who God is. Most of them would register strong discomfort and disagreement at the while I read a wonderful and remarkable paragraph from C.S. Lewis, the end of the chapter in Miracles called Christianity and Religion, that is, Christianity versus pantheism. Here is the Christian and the Jewish and the Muslim, God. Understand him and you will understand why priestesses are impossible. Scowl or puzzle at this description of God, and you will scowl or puzzle at the church's adamant no to priestesses. Men are reluctant to pass over from the notion of an abstract deity to the living God. I do not wonder. Here lies the deepest taproot of pantheism and of its objection to traditional imagery. This imagery was hated not at bottom because it pictured God as a man, because it pictured him as a king or as a warrior. The pantheist's God does nothing, demands nothing. He is there if you wish for him, like a book on a shelf. He will not pursue you. There is no danger that at any time heaven and earth will flee away at his glance. If he were the truth, then we could really say that all the Christian images of kingship were a historical accident of which our religion ought to be purged. It is with a shock that we discover them to be indispensable. You have had a shock like that before, in connection with smaller matters. When the fishing line pulls at your hand, when something breathes beside you in the darkness. So here, the shock comes at the precise moment when the thrill of life is communicated to us along the clue we have been following. It is always shocking to meet life where we thought we were alone. Look out, we cry, it's alive! And therefore, this is the very point at which so many draw back. I would have done so myself if I could, and proceed no further with Christianity. An impersonal God, well and good. A subjective God of beauty, truth, and goodness inside our own heads, better still. A formless life force surging through us, a vast power which we can tap, best of all. But God himself, alive, pulling at the other end of the cord, perhaps approaching at an infinite speed, the hunter, the king, the husband? That is quite another matter. There comes a moment when the children who have been playing at burglars hush suddenly. Was that a real footstep in the hall? There comes a moment when people who have been dabbling in religion, man's search for God, suddenly draw back. Supposing we really found him? We never meant it to come to that. Worse still, supposing he had found us. Now, if you reply that this ancient picture of the hunter, king, husband, god in scripture is historically relative, and that we should keep the essential meat and throw away the accidental shell, I reply in three ways. First, the masculinity of God is not part of the shell, but part of the nut. It is not like Hebrew grammar, a translatable, replaceable medium. It is content, data, revelation. Something so deliberate and distinctively Hebrew and all-pervasive in Scripture as the he-ness of God could not be a mere accident. Second, if it is a residue of the sin of sexism, then God revealed himself through sin. This really denies the existence of revelation. It judges the divine revelation by human opinion rather than vice versa, thus frustrating the very purpose of revelation, which is to reveal something that we couldn't have come up with from our own opinion. The assumption behind the notion of divine revelation is one which most advocates of priestesses deny, ignore, or at least are very embarrassed at. This is the notion of original sin, which entails that we are not good and wise and able to know who God is by using the best that is in us, but rather that we are rebellious and foolish and need correction, and that therefore we should expect to be surprised and even offended by God's revelation. Otherwise, our instincts would be all right and adequate and in no need of correction. Third, there is the camel's nose under the tent argument. Once you monkey with your data, where do you stop? Why stop ever at all? If you can subtract the divine masculinity from Scripture when it offends you, why can't you subtract the divine compassion when that offends you? If you read your Marxism into Scripture today, why can't you read your Nazism into Scripture tomorrow? If you can change God's masculinity, why not change his morality? Why not his very being? If you can twist the pronoun, why not twist the noun? My previous point concerned the masculinity of God. The other half of my case is the femininity of the church. The church is God's bride. We are the church. The soul is impregnated by God, not vice versa. That's why God must always be he to us and never she. Religion is intrinsically heterosexual and therefore fruitful. No lesbian love with God, therefore no goddesses, therefore no priestesses. Our new birth comes from above, from without, from transcendence. We do not spiritually impregnate ourselves with salvation or divine life any more than we physically impregnate ourselves. Modernist humanism and naturalism is really a spiritual masturbation. The connection is obvious and strong and natural and unchangeable, the connection between God's transcendence, God's masculinity, and God's revelation. As C.S. Lewis says so simply, God himself has taught us how to speak of him. The church can no more be fruitful without being impregnated by her divine husband than a woman can be pregnant with new life without a man. Feminists who resent this fact, and therefore often facts as such, and resent their own feminine nature as women as much as they resent men's masculinity. The three theological notions are tied together. Deny God's transcendence, which is the condition for his revelation, and you get a lesbian church, declaring independence from God as the other, God as transcendent, God as masculine, believing herself to be already innately in possession of divine life, that is, denying original sin, or trying to impregnate herself horizontally, humanly, by a kind of perverse autoeroticism, narcissism, and self-idolatry. Lesbians, like gays, simply cannot make life, and the lesbian spirit of women church will never be able to make life without God the Father. The Christian saints and mystics constantly use the scriptural and authoritative metaphor of God as husband to the church and to the soul. The alternative, historically, has been pagan goddesses or the pantheistic divine hermaphrodite. God made the Jews different and was extremely ornery and cantankerous about them remaining different, even to the extent of commanding the wholesale slaughter of pagan populations to prevent his chosen people from corrupting his pure revelation. Is this true? Is this divine revelation? Is this part of our data? Did God really choose and speak to the Jews? If not, If God did not invent the Jews, then the Jews invented God. In that case, let's be honest and cease to be Christians or even theists and become atheists, pagans, or pantheists, as many radical feminists have already done. Their spiritual gravity towards these three false religions is natural and inevitable. It is the agenda behind the agenda of priestesses, the worldview behind priestesses. Priestesses are merely the camel's nose under the tent, and if it is admitted, the rest of the camel will follow, because it's a one-piece camel. C.S. Lewis saw that priestesses mean not just a different polity, but a different religion. He wrote, "But why should a woman not, in this priestly sense, represent God? Well, suppose the reformer stops saying that a good woman may be like God and begins saying that God is like a good woman. Suppose he says that we might just as well pray to our Mother which art in heaven as to our Father. Suppose he suggests that the incarnation might just as well have taken a female as a male form. The second person of the Trinity could as well be called the daughter as the son. Suppose, finally, that the mystical marriage were reversed and that the church were the bridegroom and Christ the bride. All this, it seems to me, is involved in the claim that a woman can represent God as a priest does. So to say that it does not matter is to say that all the masculine imagery is not inspired, is merely human in origin, and this is surely intolerable. Or, if tolerable, it is an argument not in favor of Christian priestesses, but against Christianity. It is also, still to quote Lewis, based on a shallow view of imagery. One of the ends for which sex was created was to symbolize for us the hidden things of God. One of the functions of human marriage is to express the nature of the union between Christ and the church. Priesthood does not mean merely ministry. The new ICEL mistranslations of our liturgy, which substitute minister for priest, fail to see this blindingly obvious fact. A priest is not just a minister. Ministries like lector and Eucharistic minister, psychologist and counselor, social worker and political activist, and even prophet, can be indifferent to sex. Women can and do perform all of these ministries. But priesthood is different. No one but a priest can consecrate, can transubstantiate, or rather be the instrument of transubstantiation. A Catholic priest is not just a symbol of Christ, he is sacramentally in persona Christi. When he says, "This is my body," you hear Jesus Christ speaking. Father Murphy does not mean, "This is Father Murphy's body." The priest is not merely remembering or repeating Christ's words here, he is truly channeling them. We hear Jesus Christ actually speaking here and now when we hear these words, actually doing the miracle the words signify. A priest must be a man because Christ was a man, and this was not accidental, like his height or skin color. To see this point, consider the analogy offered by Bishop Eldon Curtis. He writes, "Could the role of Hamlet in Shakespeare's famous drama be portrayed adequately by a woman as a woman? Only if the plot were rewritten and the relationships and dialogue of the main characters substantially changed. But then it would not be the work of Shakespeare. Whereas Hamlet's fictitious life merely is recalled with each presentation of the play, in the Eucharistic celebration, the life, death, and resurrection of Christ is represented in its present reality. It would be therefore even less appropriate for a woman to portray the role of Jesus in the drama of the Eucharist." But, you may say, why is his maleness essential? Because he is the revelation of the Father, and the Father's masculinity is essential, as we have seen. The priest represents Christ, and Christ represents the Father. The priest must be male because Christ is male, and Christ is male because the Father is masculine. The obvious and ubiquitously heard objection to this view is that it is male chauvinism. As my colleague Mary Daly has written, "If God is male, then male is God." I have five answers to this charge. First, it is closer to female chauvinism, for it makes all of us female in relation to God. Women need not become like men when they approach God, but men must become like women. All souls are God's brides. Second, the fact that Christ chose to incarnate himself as a man is not chauvinism any more than the fact he chose to be a carpenter is an insult to all other professions. The incarnation was the kenosis, the emptying. He came down to the lowest place, a crucified criminal in a Roman-occupied hick town. Not an angel or an emperor, and not a woman. The incarnation was not into privilege and power, but into suffering and service, and it was into a male. It is the modern feminists who are the real male chauvinists, lusting for reproductive freedom, that is, sexual irresponsibility, like playboys, and demanding empowerment, that is, envying and imitating not only males, but male fools, judging inner worth by outer performance, sacrificing being for doing, finding their identity in their worldly careers, not in their inner essence, in their physical and spiritual wombs and motherhoods. This is what Carl Stern called the flight from woman. It is a strange and sad phenomenon. These genuinely hurt and harmed and oppressed and abused and very often raped women becoming radical feminists and hating their own femininity and hating all ordinary women who love and enjoy their ordinary femininity. How often have you heard radical feminists praise Midwestern housewives? It is the syndrome of the victims blaming themselves. Unfortunately, it happens with terrible frequency with victims of rape and child abuse. Third, Julie Lesh Wiley argues that if Jesus had been born a woman in the first century, the male-dominated world, his life and teaching of unselfish love for others would not have been as arresting and as instructively scandalous as it was. For women, in all times and places and cultures, until modern radical feminism, have always been, in general, more altruistic, less power-greedy, less violence-prone, and more self-emptying and more naturally religious than men. In becoming a man, Jesus, in a sense, let women be and went after men to transform them. Not into women, and certainly not into wimps, but into people like himself. He redefined maleness and power as courage to suffer instead of domination, giving instead of taking. Women were a little less in need of that lesson. So again, Christianity is closer to female chauvinism than male chauvinism. A fourth reason, women priests would demean and insult women, for it would be like asking women to be cross-dressers or to wear male sex organs. It would remove the distinctive dignity of women, qua women, as symbols of the church, whom Christ, symbolized by the priest, marries. Priests are signs and symbols to be looked along, not just at. So what would a priestess mean? What would it signify? It would signify to all women that they are spiritual lesbians, not brides. Fifth and finally, Christ's maleness is not chauvinistic because he had a mother, but no earthly father. Mary is the refutation of the charge of chauvinism. No merely human being was ever nearly as great as this woman, according to the teaching of this hatefully chauvinistic church. She is our tainted nature's solitary boast. Mother of God, hardly a title to sneer at. Mother of anyone is hardly a title to sneer at. To retell a story you probably heard from Kimberly last year, a boy and a girl were arguing about who would play captain in a game of pirates. The boy insisted on being the captain. The girl won the argument by agreeing, "Okay, you're the captain, but I'm the mother of the captain." The ground of Mary's greatness is the thing so simple and innocent that it's too simple and innocent for the feminists to see. The reason she is crowned Queen of Heaven, the reason for her power and glory, is her total submission to God, her sacrifice, her suffering, her service. Muslims see it, but so-called Christian feminists do not. It is Islam, the total surrender, the fiat, and the peace, the shalom, that is the secret treasure hidden in this submission. Feminism seems to be a radically different religion than Christianity because it usually has a radically opposite ideal of sanctity, of the summum bonum, of the meaning of life, of the end and point and purpose behind all religion. Feminists need most fundamentally what we all need most fundamentally, to go to the cross, unflex the fist, and bow the knee. My last two reasons against priestesses are much simpler and briefer. They are reasons of church order and discipline, and reasons of spiritual discernment. Let's be practical for a moment. In terms of the concrete life of the church, what would a church with priestesses look like? To answer this question, we must begin by backing up and asking, what is the relation between a priest and the church? And the answer to that question is clearly that the priest is for the church, not the church for the priest. The priesthood is not for personal fulfillment, and certainly not for empowerment. So the justification of changing the priesthood to include priestesshood must be the improvement of the laity, not the improvement of the priest. Improvement of the laity in what direction? In whatever direction the church is for. What is the church for? What is its end? Why did God create her? Not to be politically correct or politically incorrect, not to fulfill and happify and empower individuals, and not to stultify or unhappify or disempower individuals either, but to save and sanctify souls. That is the standard by which everything in the church must be judged, from Operation Rescue to Bingo, from ecumenical councils to the collection plate. Now, what effect would priestesses have on salvation and sanctity? For one thing, it would undermine many Catholics' confidence in the church's authority by contradicting explicit teaching and universal practice of 1900 years of history, papal declarations, patristic fathers, doctors of the church, and ecumenical councils. Even if the doctrine of no priestesses is not defined ex cathedra, to begin to ordain them would surely place this doubt in many minds. People would think, if the church was wrong for almost 2,000 years about this, why mightn't she be wrong about the rest of her teaching too? It might well even foster doubt of Christ's wisdom and infallibility, for the church's stand against priestesses, like her stand against divorce, is not based on her own idea or her own authority, but on her fidelity to his. If Jesus goofed in being so chauvinistic as not to ordain apostolesses, why might he not equally have been wrong and prejudiced and less enlightened than we are about other things, such as marriage and adultery, or even how to be saved? Second, many of the faithful would doubt the validity of women's ordination, and thus the validity of all the sacraments received from priestesses. Are my sins forgiven? Perhaps not, if an invalid ordained priestess gave me absolution, or a priest ordained by a priestess bishop. Is this really Christ I receive in the Eucharist, consecrated by a priestess, or am I blasphemously and idolatrously adoring a matzah? Third, de facto schism would result, at least enormous parish hopping, and the end of the geographical parish, and the substitution of the ideological parish. Fourth, it would tear apart the church worldwide, for nearly all other cultures except American, Canadian, and Western European culture are adamantly opposed to women's ordination. This is clear repeatedly at international bishop synods. Third world Catholics would be deeply scandalized and probably form breakaway churches. The Lefebvreite tragedy would be magnified 10,000 times. The church would be irredeemably fractured from its own tradition and therefore against itself. The Protestant Reformation a second time. The direction would clearly be demonic, not divine, tearing apart, not uniting. So, for practical and prudential reasons, priestesses would be an ecclesiastical disaster. For principial reasons, too, for the feminists fail to understand what a priest is, not only sacramentally and symbolically, as we have already seen, but ecclesially and socially, too. For there is only one reason to be a priest, because you are called by God. Now, how do you know the will of God? The only public and objective and certain way to know the will of God is by divine revelation. And God has revealed through the church what he wants a priest to be. If anyone does not believe that the church's teachings are God's revelation, they are simply not Catholics. God has not let important things like who he is and how to be saved and the sacraments of his church depend on our feelings or opinions. We can talk back to our mother, the church, but she always has the last word because she is God's mouth. The church tells us that the priesthood is not a right and not a privilege. No one can claim a right to be a priest. She also tells us that priesthood is for the service of others, not personal advantage, not even for personal holiness. Being a priest does not make you better or holier. If it does, that's only a side effect of its main business, which is to make the laity better and holier. Advocates of priestesses usually argue that to deny a woman this function is to insult her personal worth. This is a false functionalist argument which confuses personal worth with function, like the arguments that justify early abortions or euthanasia by pointing out that this brain is not functioning rationally. This error, by the way, is more typical of males than females, for men have always tended to identify themselves and their worth with their jobs or their achievements, while women have always, up to now, tended to the traditional wisdom that being is more important than doing. Over 99% of all men also don't function as priests, and many of them can't, by reason of age or physical condition. Are they therefore less valuable and worthy human beings? If not, then neither are women, for the same reason. A woman can't be a father either, the other kind of father. Is this also a slap in the face at her dignity? Has nature already insulted women in the same way as the church is doing? The more radical feminists will answer yes, thus revealing their own male chauvinism and fragile sense of self-worth. The others are hard-pressed to justify blaming the church but not blaming nature. Neither nature nor the church is simple-mindedly egalitarian. The most egregious error of all is the demand to be priestesses for empowerment. I can think of no term that more perfectly proves the speaker's utter incomprehension of what she says than that. It is like wanting to manage the Boston Red Sox because of your thirst for success. Priests are not power brokers or managers. They are sewers. Like Christ, they drain off the world's sins. They are spiritual garbage men. Like Christ, they clean up our spiritual garbage. They wash dirty, smelly feet, as he did before he died. The Pope, priest of priests, is Servus Servorum Dei, servant of God's servants. This is not a clever PR lie. This is his real job description. So even if all my other reasons against priestesses were invalid, their total misunderstanding of their essential job description would invalidate them. Anyone with even a little wisdom and discernment should see this instinctively. And this brings me to my fourth and last and shortest kind of reason against priestesses, reasons of discernment, which is perhaps the most important of all. Can we discern what spirit is at work here? We need not be very advanced or expert in the Christian art of the discernment of spirits to answer that question. All we need to do is listen. And if we listen with a heart open to God rather than ideology, we will hear the anger, the rage, the self-righteousness. Who are the advocates of women's ordination? The most prominent are always dissenters against other official church teachings as well. The issue is not an isolated issue. Pull its thread and the whole seamless garment comes unraveled. By the way, dissenter is just modern euphemism for heretic. Both words mean exactly the same thing. One who says no, one who picks and chooses for himself, one who refuses to eat all the food mommy puts on her plate. Most shockingly, most feminists behind priestesses are also strong advocates of abortion. That seems to me immediately and totally to destroy all their credentials to a hearing. For we know what God the priestesses of abortion serve, and his name is not Jesus, his name is Moloch. Moloch, like Jesus, also says, "Suffer the little children to come unto me." But where Jesus places his hand on their heads, Moloch places his teeth. In addition to approving of abortion, the leaders of the push for priestesses also want the church to approve contraception, fornication, sodomy, same-sex marriage, and divorce. A more complete and demonic attack on the family could not possibly be orchestrated, even in hell. Some of the leaders in the movement, such as the so-called nuns in Women Church, clearly admit that they are worshiping another god, Mother Earth, and practicing another religion, paganism, Christ's old enemy, risen from the dead. Anyone who freely opens the church doors to these barbarians is clearly a traitor. Anyone who can't see through these spies' tissue paper-thin cover of Catholicism is a fool. The origin of modern feminism is not inside Christianity, but outside it.
in secular, usually Marxist or deconstructionist ideologies, that is deeply anti-Christian, anti-religious, anti-theistic. Mary Daly, my famous colleague at Boston College, summarized her self-image candidly when she called herself in print, in her book Pure Lust, the Antichrist, and summarized her life's work as, quote, castrating God the Father. Next to her, Nietzsche was a wimp. Politics may make strange bedfellows like these for liberal theologians, but discernment of God's will, holiness, prayer, and submission never do. In fact, the advocates of priestesses never seem to speak of these things at all. This is another telling credential. There is an obvious match between the root or source of their spirit, which is not prayer, and the fruit or face of their spirit, which is not love or joy or peace. This sentence will make some people extremely angry, but it is true. It will make people angry because it is true. Look at their faces. You can see the hate, the hardness, and the hurt. In the spiritual exercises, St. Ignatius says we must discern between the spirit of consolation and the spirit of desolation, which produces hate, anxiety, fear, resentment, anger, anguish, bitterness, rage, pain, and lack of peace. By their own admission, these are precisely the feelings of those in the forefront of the demands for priestesses. These are not passing moods, but a settled state of deep alienation. They are not the feelings of a few individuals, but of the movement itself, of its very ideology. We can easily discern in them a past history of having been badly hurt, which then became a state of deep hatred and self-righteousness. Father Paul Klee, S.J., characterized it this way. This is not a matter of succumbing to momentary irritation and passing flarings of anger, but everything indicates a settled mood of the most profound self-pity, which is another name for wounded pride, something most assuredly not from God. Well, if not from God, then against Him. For whoever is not for us is against us. This is especially true in this time of decadence and decay in both church and society, this time of perhaps apocalyptic spiritual warfare. The issue goes beyond one of sacramental theory and ecclesiastical discipline. It is an issue of the priests of the Lord versus the priests of Baal, and a time for choosing not only between theologies, but between gods, a time for repeating Joshua's challenge to Israel. Remember, Joshua means Jesus, and the church is the new Israel. Now, therefore, fear the Lord and serve Him in sincerity and in faithfulness, and put away the gods which your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. And if you be unwilling to serve the Lord, choose you this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your fathers served in the region beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord.